I'd like to welcome you back to the show. There's only two people in the state of California that I believe know exactly how to fix California. One of them is Victor Davis Hanson, who is a fellow at the Stanford Institution, Hoover Institution at Stanford, is now on Fox and all the rest. We've had him on a few times over the years, but he's written columns on it. Our next guest has actually written a book on it. And his insight, his analysis, and everything is nothing short of prescient and brilliant. His name is Ed Ring. He is he's a senior fellow with the California Policy Center. He's got his brand new book out, and we're going to talk about that. Ed, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Andy. Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. So tell us, you wrote this series of articles, and you have a book out, and tell us all about it, Restoring the California Dream, or Fixing California. What, I guess the series was Fixing California, and the book is Restoring the California Dream?
It's the same material in both cases, but we decided to soup up the title a little bit. This is a Kindle book. It's only about 25,000 words, and it's something that you can either read online. If you go to the California Policy Center website, it's right there. And that's, of course, called Fixing California. It's a 9-part series. And the series, and it's also on Amazon, Restoring the California Dream. But, you know, it's got an introduction and a conclusion. And then the 7 interior sections for these installments focus on energy, water, transportation, housing, homelessness, and law enforcement. We link those two together, forest management, and education. And in every case, you know, I won't say it's easy, but there's a lot of work, very good work being done, investigative reporting being done on what's wrong and where there is corruption. And that's, you know, very important to do that. But the attempt here was to, all right, There it is. You know, these are our problems that we've got in California. How do we fix them? And so, you know, we tried to make this, and I had support from the California Policy Center, something where we put together an agenda. The timing, of course, coincides with this recall election. And we're trying to put together the best we can, because somebody's got to do this. An agenda for politicians. It's a bipartisan agenda. It's a populist agenda. It's a common sense agenda of how we can fix the problems that we've got. What are the solutions? And these are an attempt at listing all of those solutions. It gets a little wonky here and there, but it's pretty readable. And it's, again, more than just summarizing the problems. Here's what we can do about it.
Well, you know, I quoted you for a couple of years, and I still do. When you wrote your piece about the abundance choice, and folks, what they want us to do, and again, Ed wrote this, is argue over scarcity. So their agenda is scarcity and austerity, when in reality, from time immemorial, we used to say, well, if we've got a shortage of something, let's make more of it. And in the name of Malthusian, in the name of conservation, less is more, in the name of environmental extremism, et cetera, we shifted. And so, you know, when Ed and I talked about this, like, you know, most of the California population is near the coast, and we're border the Pacific Ocean. There's no reason every county couldn't have 1 or 2 desal plants along that coastline and have no water shortages whatsoever.
You know, that's a good topic. The first part is called The Themes That Make Anything Possible, and it's an exploration of 3 concepts: abundance, pragmatism, and optimism. Abundance, you just explained, and you're absolutely right. And pragmatism is what we need to sort of get through the partisanship that's also causing a lot of the obstacles to getting things actually done. People are rejecting ideas based on ideology. They're not looking at what a practical solution could be, or if they see one, they're not allowed to support it because it's an idea that someone in the other party had. And we have to be optimistic about this because the long-term trend of humanity is upward. And, you know, we're in an era right now where there's all kinds of things happening. It's very complicated. There's a lot of things to sort out, a lot of values to balance. But we have to be optimistic about it and assume that eventually the right ideas will catch hold. And your comment about desalination is worth exploring a little bit, because if you look at the objections to desalination, they're simply unfounded. I read a recent report, I think it was in Reuters, where of course, the journalist was not looking into it themselves. They were regurgitating talking points coming from an environmentalist group that, you know, is, I think, being unreasonable about what the costs and benefits of desalination really are. They're talking about a plant, the one down in San Diego, that produces 60,000 acre feet of water a year. It's almost 10% of all the water that they need in San Diego County. And they say it's destroying a 400 acre segment of ocean. And there's two things in that quote that sounds scary that you got to think about. First of all, you're talking about less than one square mile. And secondly, what do you really mean by destroying
exactly
that segment of ocean? You know, it's some, you know, measurable decrease in the amount of plankton that may be in the 1 or 2%. I don't know exactly, but I've talked with the people that engineered that plant. I've talked with people that are in favor of desalination, along with experts on the other side, and they have mitigated desalination very well. But there's another point to be made here, which is desalination is the solution. This is a global solution. Desalination plants are being built all over the world, and they're going to continue to get built because it's the only way we're going to solve water scarcity in a lot of parts of the world. And if you look at where they're discharging and intaking water and discharging brine, in the rest of the world, there's places like the Persian Gulf, the Red Sea, the Arabian Sea, the Mediterranean Sea, where there's no current. You know, there's nowhere in the world, practically nowhere else in the world, where we have such a current. The California Current's the second biggest current on Earth, the Gulf Stream's the only one that's bigger. It moves all the time at about 2 knots, and you're talking about billions of tons, you know, trillions of tons of water that are just flowing past our coast. And to disperse a few million acre feet of brine
is insane
into this current.
All right.
Absolutely nothing.
All right, Ed, we're going to take a break. Our guest, Ed Ring. Again, the series is called Fixing California, the ebook, Restoring the California Dream. You're listening to the Andy Caldwell. I'd like to welcome you back to the show. My guest, Ed Ring, he wrote a series of policy papers calling Fixing California, and he turned it into a book. It's called Restoring the California Dream. He is a senior fellow with the California Policy Center. So before the break, Ed, we were talking about how some of the people, they are not exercising or in involving themselves in a pragmatic attitude or outlook. And I would say that what they are doing is they're obfuscating the obvious. And more importantly, in this piece that I have where you describe your work, it talks about how optimism is so important. But we had a guy named Robert Zubrin who came to speak to our membership a few years back, and he wrote a book called Merchants of Despair, and he asked the same question. This guy's got a PhD, I think several PhDs, and he'd asked, him and some other guys were sitting around thinking, why are people despairing over all these issues that are solvable? For instance, electricity problems or shortages, he'd go with nuclear. Water issues, he'd go with desal. you know, there's solutions. And he came up to the fact that they're selling despair to control people and the economy.
You know, I don't know how much I can add to that. There's a, you know, if you look at just the curricula in our public schools, and it's mirrored in the media, you have all these crises, you know, the climate emergency, the crisis of systemic racism, the catastrophe of capitalist enslavement. You know, this is an oppressive, exploitative society. And why? You're right. I mean, it's something that gets people emotionally agitated. It's a way to sell, you know, your agenda to people, because they're scared and they're working from emotion now instead of reason. It's also profitable, and I think that, you know, where there's scarcity, there's profit, and where there's you know, rationing, there's political power. So there's an agenda behind this that goes beyond the mere emotional power of selling fear and selling an emergency. There's an agenda of power and profit that underlies this, unfortunately, and that has to be exposed and broken as well. But the way to expose it and break it is not merely to investigate and uncover all of the corruption, for example. It's to explain the alternatives. You know, look at the bright side. This is what we can do to fix these problems. And you talk about nuclear power desalination. There's all kinds of ways to get more water. You know, we can fix the aqueducts. We can build a few more off-stream surface reservoirs. We can fill the underground caverns all over the Central Valley and in the L.A. Basin with storm runoff. We can recycle up, I think, 3 million acre-feet of treated wastewater goes into the Pacific Ocean. This is imported water that goes into L.A. and the San Francisco Bay Area. It's imported water that just ends up after one use getting discharged into the Pacific or the San Francisco Bay. We could use that water again. There's all kinds of ways to get more water, and there's all kinds of ways to have more energy. Nuclear power is on the cusp of being a solution of tremendous power, because we're going to get fusion power one of these decades. It's been like 20 years away for the last 50 years, but I think they're getting close. So there are solutions, Andy. Let's turn the timber companies loose again and do it right. But we could thin the forests, create jobs, and create tax revenue.
And reduce forest fires.
Out of the way.
And reduce forest fires, which, you know, again, most of us, I've been in California since I was 3 years old, and I've never seen anything like this. And I don't believe it's because of climate change. I believe it's because of policy changes. We don't thin, we don't do control burns, we don't do fire breaks, we don't log. There's all sorts of things we quit doing right around the same time these fires started getting out of control.
And it got worse, Andy, because we got better and better at the same time as we stopped doing all the things you just described. We got better and better at fire suppression.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if you think that climate change is the reason we're having hotter summers and we're in the midst of another drought, I mean, even if you think that climate change is the reason for that, why wouldn't you want to manage the forests and do all the things you just described? Thinning, timber harvesting, controlled burns. Why wouldn't you want to do all of that stuff if we're having climate change? So their argument falls flat on its face.
You know, the other thing with homeless, you know, the other thing is what you mentioned in this piece. Not only do they not solve problems, they make things worse.
Yeah, and with the forests, of course, that's the classic example.
And the homeless,
these
too.
These overgrown forests are because we didn't do any of the – we suppressed fires, we let everything get overgrown. And the trees are dying and burn more easily because there's too many of them. The tree density is way beyond historical norms all through our northern forests in California. And that's not climate change that caused that overgrowth. That's fire suppression.
Well, let me explain something.
Yeah.
So when these density, to our audience, not you, so when these forests are 10 times more trees per acre than there should be, those trees have less water, they have less nutrients, and they have less sunlight. that sets them up to be weak. And when they're weak, they get inflicted by some bark beetle or what have you. And then they die. And then the whole thing goes up as kindling. So it's a cycle
exactly
that they're
right.
starting. Yeah.
And we get less water as
yes.
well. Because
yes.
there's no runoff anymore. Those
right.
roots from all of those competing overgrown trees suck up all the water as soon as it hits the ground. So there's the watersheds themselves no longer contribute as much water into the springs and rivers with whatever rain we get because of these the overgrowth.
You know, finally, the homeless issue and housing. Let's talk about housing. You mentioned here that, suburban sprawl, they want to say that's a curse word, but you actually say it's a good thing. You have 2 minutes
yeah.
to tell us why.
It's a beautiful thing. People, the polls that say people would rather live in higher density neighborhoods are based on asking somebody, what can you afford? You
right.
know, and all they can afford is living in a condo. So they go, yeah, I'd rather live in a condo. So I'm only spending, 30% of my gross income on rent instead of 40 or 50% on a mortgage. But if you got the cost down, there's plenty of data that shows that most people, especially families, want to have a detached single-family dwelling. You can't possibly do this topic justice in 2 minutes, but if we built the enabling infrastructure like we used to do, if we had more water, more energy, better roads, we could expand our suburbs along transportation corridors. You could be on the slopes, the western slopes of the Central Valley. It's wasteland. There's 25,000 square miles of cattle ranching area. Think about it. You could put 10 million people on quarter-acre lots with an equal amount for shopping centers and industrial parks and streets and roads, and you would only use up 2,000 square miles. You'd use up less than 10% of that 25,000 square miles. The entire urban footprint in California is only 8,000 square miles. You could add suburbs housing 10 million more people, and you'd only increase that by 20%. California is a very big state. There's plenty of places to allocate land and let people develop their property and let the private sector take over, get the costs down by deregulating, making the permits cost less, using the government like they used to
All right.
to build the roads. That's how it can be done.
Absolutely. And the other thing is you could just lay out a map to provide housing. They will not show how much of the state they would need to cover with windmills and solar panels to come up with a pittance of our energy supply. Ed, come back. I'd love to have you on regularly.
Anytime, Andy. I really appreciate the chance. Thanks.
All right. We're going to be back. You're listening to the Andy Caldwell Show.